Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Every year, almost 25 million Americans suffer from a heart attack or other forms of heart disease, and many of these people may find themselves suddenly hospitalized for emergency surgery. The process of recovery can be confusing, and it can be frightening for both the patient and for their family. This morning, we'll be reviewing some of the basics on cardiac care and rehabilitation, going from the first diagnosis to the prevention of future heart attacks. And our guest for the program in this first hour is Dr. Paul Klingfield. He is professor of medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He's also director of the Cardiac Health Center in New York City and is the author of a newly published book, which is titled The Cardiac Recovery Handbook, The Complete Guide to Life After Heart Attack or Heart Surgery. It's published by Healthy Living Books, and it should be out now in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Your questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. But you're also welcome, if it would be a long-distance call, to use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Dr. Klingfield, hello.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Sure.
We appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
I'm really struck by that number, and I'm assuming I got it from the publicity materials that came from the book, so I'm assuming that that's accurate, that 25 million Americans, either people who have a heart attack or have some serious form of heart disease, there's some sort of blockage, there's some sort of arrhythmia, something like that, that requires immediate and serious medical attention.
Well, I think the 25 million refers to the total number of people at risk in the population or at high risk in the population. There are somewhere in the range of probably half a million to a million heart attacks each year that occur within that population.
Well, since the sort of the premise of the book is that there are people who have a problem and may not know it until you get to the point where they need to have serious intervention, either people who have a heart attack or people who do have some symptom that concerns them that takes them to their doctor. And then when the doctor checks them out, the doctor says, hey, we've got a serious problem here and we need to do something about it. I guess that makes me wonder whether we have a lot of people who either A, have symptoms and they're not paying attention to them until they get really bad, or B, there are people who have potential problems. They may have heart disease in the making. They may indeed have heart disease, but the symptoms aren't obvious enough to them to catch their attention.
Well, I think that's a terrific insight, David, and you're absolutely right. I think our appreciation of the nature of the disease has changed considerably over the last two decades. The old theory was that with bad diet and bad habits, fatty foods, plaque started to build up inside of the arteries, including the arteries that supply blood to the heart, and that the longer you ingest things that clog up the arteries, the more likely they are to become blocked. And the further things become blocked, the more limited the blood supply to the heart will be until some sort of symptom occurs. And then if that gets worse and worse and it's ignored, and the blockage becomes so severe that it totally clogs up the coronary artery, which is nothing but a living pipe, then the blood supply to the heart would be cut off and you'd have a heart attack. And in that context, one would seriously wonder why it is that somewhere between the onset of the disease and the final heart attack, people are not affected with lots of symptoms. And I think we know the answer to that now, and the answer to that is that traditional explanation for how heart attacks evolve is really the exception rather than the rule. And in fact, we've known for a long time that people often have heart attacks as the first presentation of their disease, so that the model of disease has changed. And what we now know is that there are small injuries to the inside of the arteries that can produce all at once a catastrophic cascade of blood clotting that produces the heart attack itself. So it is very common for people to have no symptoms before a heart attack.
Well, given the fact that I think probably a lot of people, if we ask them, what are the risk factors for heart disease, it's gotten enough publicity so that they would probably be able to name some number of things, including high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high fat diet, lack of exercise, being overweight, cigarette smoking, all of those sorts of things. But if you take an individual who doesn't have any really doesn't have those factors. Say their weight's okay. Maybe they're not a great exerciser, but it's a moderate exercise. Their cholesterol is not as good as perhaps it might be, but it's okay, and doesn't have any symptoms. Then what I wonder is, for someone who doesn't really fit the profile of high risk, what sort of screening, or is there anything that you can do in, by way of screening, to look at some large number of individuals who are not obviously at risk to detect heart disease earlier on in the process?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a number of risk factors that are evident that we can't do anything about. The most important of these is heredity. We know that obstruction of the coronary arteries tends to be a familial disorder, while it is something that presents earlier in men than it does in women. Women are by no means spared from this disease. They tend to just get it at a slightly older age. But there's nothing much you can do about your family history besides be aware of it. Other risk factors that can't be changed are sex and age. So there's nothing much you can do about those things. But there are other risk factors that you mentioned that are modifiable that can be dealt with in a common sense way or sometimes in a medical way. And modifying the risk has been shown to modify the outcome. So if there is apparent risk in something that can be changed, then changing that risk has a favorable outcome, often a very dramatic outcome. Perhaps the most obvious example would be stopping smoking. As soon as you stop smoking, your risk of dying of a heart attack is dramatically reduced. And that's been obvious now for decades. It takes some years for the effects of the smoking to go away, but in terms of the immediate cardiac consequences, in terms of unstable rhythms during a heart attack that predispose to death, there's improvement there right away. Unfortunately, smoking is one of the hardest things to modify because the addiction is so strong. Other things that are important, though, that can be looked at and are not apparent, and they're not things that people are aware of or can feel, are things like blood pressure, which should be monitored and checked and lowered where appropriate, and also, obviously, cholesterol levels, which can be monitored and checked and dealt with either by diet in some circumstances or with the use of additional medication.
Do you see the day, though, when we would have something as simple as a blood test, or perhaps something as simple, relatively simple as an X-ray, that you could do with a large number of people to get a better read on who might be headed towards heart disease?
Well, I think we have many of those things now, and risk for populations of people or people with certain characteristics can be predicted in a statistical sense. Of course, for any one person, that may not be completely accurate, but for groups of people, these risk predictors tend to be fairly accurate. We can look at, in addition to age, the total cholesterol level. We can look at things like components of the cholesterol, whether there's good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, balance problem that predisposes people. We can look at blood pressure and add all of that up and come up with some estimate of risk that have been validated in national trials. So we can identify people who are at higher risk and people at lower risk.
One of the things that we know is that one of the risk factors for heart disease is high blood cholesterol. And we also certainly know that there is a relationship between that and diet, and also between particular components of that and exercise. And that you can take people, if you do a blood test and it's no big deal, you can draw the blood and you can get a reading, and then you can say to them, okay, look, we think that your cholesterol is too high and here's what we want you to do. We want you to have a healthier diet. We want you to cut down on your fat. And we think it would be a good idea for you to have some regular exercise. And if you do that, a lot of people will manage to lower their cholesterol some, and maybe even significantly. Then, though, I guess we get to this question where that says, okay, now once we have done that and we feel that we have done what we can by that method, it is possible to put people on medication to lower their cholesterol further. And it seems that particularly within the last couple of years, there's been a lot of debate within the medical community about at what point you decide to put somebody on medication and how many people should be on cholesterol-lowering medication. And there seem to be some people, at least in the cardiology community, who think we should be pretty aggressive and that even more people than are already taking that medication should be taking it. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think that you need to back up to the issue of risk. For people at very, very low risk, the notion of taking medication that may not be absolutely necessary, you know, is a rather extreme way to go. But for people at very high risk, a relatively safe medication, in addition to the lifestyle changes that you mentioned, may be the most reasonable thing to do. Whether the lipid-lowering drugs should be put in the drinking water, as some people suggest, you know, like fluoride, as good for everybody, I think is arguable, and that never will be a reasonable thing to say because there are side effects and costs and downsides to all medications. But we're getting to a point where people at high risk now often cannot achieve the recommended levels of cholesterol lowering with diet and exercise alone. And for those people, the advantages of taking some of the cholesterol lowering drugs can be dramatic.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Klingfield. He's professor of medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He's also director of the Cardiac Health Center in New York City and is the author of a new book, which is titled The Cardiac Recovery Handbook. The subtitle is The Complete Guide to Life After Heart Attack or Heart Surgery, and it's published by Healthy Living Books, and questions are welcome. I'm sure that if you had some general questions about heart disease, the doctor would do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about something that I'm sure that people within your field are very interested in, and it's something that definitely bears more investigation. And we've talked about the role that that diet and cholesterol plays in the narrowing of the blood vessels that supply the heart and how that can cause a problem. There are apparently also some people who think that maybe infection, either bacterial or viral infection, may have some sort of role in heart disease. I think more and more there are researchers who are interested in the possibility of viral infection having a role in some number of diseases, maybe not as being the only cause, but being either one cause or a contributing factor. What, at this point, what's the thinking about the role that infection might play in heart disease?
Well, I think that this is science in progress. There is no question that infection is a plausible contributor to coronary heart disease as well as to disease in other arteries of the body. And the reason for that is that if you look at the problem, if you look at the atherosclerotic lesion itself, this is the plaque that builds up inside the artery to partially obstruct the vessel and ultimately become the source for clotting on top of the plaque that causes blockage and heart attacks. The lesion itself it looks very much like an inflammation of the inner lining of the artery. And inflammation can be caused by any kind of irritation or injury, or, in fact, a common source of inflammation is infection. This could be by viruses, it could be by bacteria, and there have been a number of viruses and bacteria and other agents that have been suspected to play a role in acceleration of the disease. I think that the best data available now would suggest that while this is plausible and may occur in some cases, it's not going to turn out to be the cause. There's not likely to be one bacterium or one virus that causes atherosclerotic disease and heart attacks. But I think there's a subset of people where the process is probably accelerated or even triggered by some infection.
We have some callers now we don't get to, and we'll go first to somebody listening in Indiana. That'll be our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. two questions and an anecdote. Anecdote. My father was up in a cottonwood tree cutting limbs, and one of the limbs gave way, and he fell all the way down to the ground. They took him to the hospital, and he was in there for a couple of days for observation and stuff, then left, and I think about 10 days later, he died in his sleep with a blood clot. And I discovered, was told that, and I went and said something to the personnel, and they said there were no indications to use an MIR, I think they said, where then, you know, the blood clot could have been found, perhaps. I don't know. I wonder if you could speak to that. And the two questions deal with trauma to the artery. Is it something like if you hit, say, your arm on the inside hard enough, could you do some damage to an artery that could cause you problems later? And second question deals with chest pains. I've asked a number of people about what kind of chest pain is that, and they say, well, you'll know it when it happens. And, well, all my chest pains I noticed, you know. So there's some kind of relativity here, and I just wondered what that could be. I have chest pains every once in a while, but oftentimes in terms of common sense, I can trace them back to something you know, I've been doing or something like that, or perhaps it's a muscle thing. And that's always confused me. If you could take those apart, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure. Let me start with the chest pain issue first. I think your observation is a very good one. The Heart Association has spent years now of trying to alert the public to the importance of chest pain without actually being very specific about what kind of chest pain we're talking about. And there's a good reason for that, and that is that while there are typical forms of chest pain that are associated with heart disease, and I'll describe the typical form for you, it is also possible for people to have very atypical presentations of heart attacks, so that there is no absolute way to tell you that this is not your heart. Now, if you tell me that every time you eat a pepperoni pizza, okay, and follow it up with something bigger than your head and swallow it all down, you get a discomfort in your chest and a burning that goes away if you take an antacid, then I can relatively confidently tell you that that's not your heart, okay? You know, that's just indigestion. The characteristic kind of chest discomfort that's associated with heart attack is usually a central squeezing that may radiate to the arms, more commonly to the left arm, sometimes up into the jaw. Usually to the inside of the left arm when it does. May go through to the back. When this begins, it usually starts with exercise because the underlying problem is often a partial blockage in the artery. And so the symptom would be a discomfort in the center of the chest, maybe going to the arm, that comes on with exercise and then is relieved when you stop exercising, because then the work of the heart goes down below the available blood supply again. And so you begin to develop an association of what's precipitating the symptom. And that allows you to either say this is consistent with something that could be heart pain, or when there's evident other reasons, this is something that is explainable by something else, something in the way of stomach problems, something in the way of musculoskeletal pain. If you've injured your neck or you've injured your back, and every time you turn your head in a certain way, you get chest pain, then that's not likely to be cardiac as well. So the kinds of chest pains that we tend to pay the most attention to in terms of diagnosing heart disease are the kind that sort of come on with exercise and tend to be relieved by rest. That's the most typical presentation of coronary disease. But again, almost anything can be. The distinction between the reversible kind of chest pain that's caused by heart disease and a heart attack is one of intensity and duration. The heart that hurts because it's not getting enough blood supply because you're exercising it too hard beyond the available supply, when you stop, that discomfort will go away, and that usually lasts for somewhere in the range of 5 minutes. A heart attack, which is usually caused by complete obstruction due to a blood clot, doesn't go away when you rest, and that pain usually increases over the course of at least a half hour or so. And so I think in general most people do know that something is seriously wrong, but they may not be able to be absolutely sure it's their heart, and they shouldn't be expected to do that. That's what our emergency system is set up to try and tease apart. The original notion of the Heart Association to get to the hospital to get some help when you think you might be having a heart attack is well-founded, because the death rate from heart attacks is greatest in the earliest hours of the heart attack. Now, your other issues are very, very broad, and it's very hard for me to generalize about what might have happened when your dad fell out of the tree. But there are two consequences. I mean, you asked about trauma to the heart and to the arteries. That certainly is the case. I mean, it's my understanding that Princess Diana, as a result of her auto accident, died because the impact sheared one of the major blood vessels apart. So that certainly can happen. There can also be injuries like that, not only from car accidents, but from falls. And there is a literature on people who've fallen great distances and hit their chests, which can shear arteries apart, which is capable of injuring directly the heart and can cause a bruise to the heart muscle itself just from the impact. So all of that is plausible. And in terms of the blood clot, it would depend on where this blood clot was thought to be that you started your question with and observation with. There are blood clots that go to the lungs that are often a result of injury and lack of mobility in people who are hospitalized for a while. And that's a recognized risk of being in bed for a period of time. And then there are blood clots that form within the arteries themselves, which are somewhat less predictable and less related to direct injury.
Just for a second to go back to the question about chest pain, I'm thinking back to not very long ago when there was a lot of publicity about President Clinton and his heart disease and having gone in for surgery. And as I recall, the symptom that concerned him was not that he was having pain with physical exertion, but that he was having pain when he was at rest. And apparently when that got out, we had all kinds of people calling their doctors and going down to the emergency room because they thought they had that symptom, that is, that they were having chest pain when they were not exerting themselves. Can you talk about that?
I was not involved with President Clinton's care, so I can't comment directly on what his specific symptoms were or were not. But generally, symptoms that come on at rest, as opposed to being provoked by exercise, suggest that there is some acceleration of the process going on to the point where even at rest, the blood supply is not adequate to supply enough blood to the heart. Whereas before, at least in the traditional hypothesis where things get progressively more blocked until you have a heart attack, at least before when the blockage is not so bad, you only get the limitation when you sort of strain the heart and make it work harder than the blood supply will permit. So by definition, a transition from exercise-related heart pain to rest-related heart pain is really an emergency situation, because it suggests that the blood supply to the heart is so limited that it can't even support the activity of the heart at rest.
Well, here, and I'm not asking a question specifically about Mr. Clinton, but would it be reasonable to surmise that someone complaining about chest pain at rest would in fact have had some chest pain with exertion before that?
If the traditional understanding that people have had for most of the 20th century were true, you would expect to see that. But in fact, we don't see that all that often. We do see it sometimes, but it's more the exception than the rule. And the fact that people can go from being normal one day to having a big heart attack the next day indicates that disease in the arteries is not a very slow progressive one most of the time, but can be an abrupt changing situation. The cartoon example of that is everyone's favorite story of the person who goes to the doctor, has a completely normal physical and has an exercise test that's absolutely normal, and then goes home and has a heart attack the next week. Before, we used to say that, well, that exercise test wasn't very good. But we now know that the exercise test is probably correct. There probably was no blockage that was severely limiting, even during exercise, the week before. And what changed over the course of the week is not progressive deposition of more and more fat. you know, into that artery to completely block it. But what changed was a catastrophic change within a mild narrowing in the vessel itself, whether that's brought on by an infection, whether it's brought on by inflammation, whether it's brought on by something as yet to be determined, or an injury, we don't know. But something happened to trigger a cascade of events that caused that vessel to close.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Klingfield. He's professor of medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He's also director of the Cardiac Health Center in New York City and the author of the book, The Cardiac Recovery Handbook, which is just recently out, published by Healthy Living Books. We're at our midpoint here. We have some other callers, and we'd be very happy to take questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next is Urbana in line one. Hello.
Yes, I read an article that there really are sort of two forms of heart attack. One is the model that you presented where you get a plaque build up in the artery and decreased blood flow. And the other is due to arrhythmia, which causes cardiac arrest. Now, this was an article and I didn't understand it all. And I don't know how the two are related or if they are different models. So my question is for you to comment on it.
Sure. The kind of rhythm irregularity that can cause death can be caused and often is caused by a heart attack. The leading cause of death in patients having heart attacks now is a sudden fatal rhythm irregularity. By rhythm irregularity, what we're talking about is the electrical regulation of the heartbeat, which can become so chaotic that the heartbeat itself becomes chaotic enough so it doesn't pump anymore. That's the traditional cardiac arrest that you see as an end-stage event in various kinds.
Well, what causes that?
The cause for that there are multiple causes for that, and I think that is getting to your question. The common traditional cause of that is during a heart attack when the heart muscle is deprived of blood, it becomes unstable, and the electrical properties of the heart that are involved in the heart attack become unstable so that the electrical signal is distorted and goes wild effectively. That's the reason for getting to the hospital right away, because the hospital has the ability, using an electric shock, to make that rhythm go back to normal. Now, there is another form of fatal cardiac rhythm that can kill people and could be considered another kind of heart attack, although these are usually not classified as heart attacks because they may not be associated with any heart muscle damage, which is what a heart attack is. But some people are susceptible to rhythm irregularities in its own right, and there are two broad categories of that. So that people who've had a heart attack in the past or have had heart muscle damage in the past or scarring of the heart for various reasons may be susceptible to the same kinds of rhythm irregularities that people have during an acute heart attack, and they can be fatal as well. So that the kind of distinction that you're making is a reasonable one, and attention to detection of people who are at risk for that kind of rhythm irregularity in the absence of a heart attack is a great area of investigation now, and which much progress is being made.
Could I ask one follow-up?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think about home defibrillators for individual homes?
Well, I think that there are two things to think about. When we can determine that somebody is at high risk for having fibrillation, which is the irregular rhythm that can be fatal that we're talking about now, either during the course of a heart attack or separate from an acute heart attack. When the risk of having this rhythm is high, the current approach to that is actually to implant a pacemaker-like device that actually is a defibrillator into the patient. And that can be life-saving in people who are at high risk of having this kind of a electrical irregular event. So yes, individualized defibrillators separate from the hospital and separate from the emergency room and separate from the paramedics is a very, very important advance in modern technological medicine. And it starts really with implantable defibrillators in people who are at high risk. Now, that doesn't do anything for the population, that whole, who are not individually at high risk, but collectively are at high risk, because we know that these kinds of sudden arrhythmic events can occur even in relatively lower risk populations. When you get enough people in one place, that can happen. And so there is a great push now to have automatic external defibrillators, not implantable defibrillators, but defibrillators that hang on the wall that are accessible to the public for specifically this purpose, so that if someone collapses because of a sudden unexpected arrhythmia, you don't have to wait for paramedics to arrive or for a patient to be transported to a hospital, which can be too time-consuming for survival. And we know that the earlier people are defibrillated, the more likely they are to survive. And so the push has been by the Heart Association to get these kinds of automatic external defibrillators spread pretty widely around the country. Certainly office buildings, airplanes now carry them. They're in airports. They are increasingly available. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the average family, you know, should buy one of these things, but it could ultimately come to something like that, where that would be kind of a safety device like a fire extinguisher or, you know, alarm system that people might consider having around.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to the next caller, and that would be in Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I have a question about alternative therapies, because you're from the Weill Institute. Would you feel comfortable answering that? Or
I don't see why not.
Okay. Then the question, they're about hypertension and high cholesterol. I've been looking at reflexology, and one of the things that reflexology is supposed to treat is hypertension. Do you feel that those claims are justified?
I think that many forms of alternative medicine work, but I am not prepared to say that if they don't work, we would not look to more traditional methods of treating the high blood pressure.
My question, I'll be more specific. My question is, do you have any evidence that reflexology has been useful in treating hypertension?
Well, we have a lot of evidence that various kinds of stress management, okay, of which reflexology, I think, could be considered a component part, various forms of stress management methods can have very profound effects on blood pressure. So I think it's possible that some people with relatively mild blood pressure problems would be adequately treated that way.
Okay, and then the next two questions are about treatments that I've heard of for high cholesterol. One is tree ear mushrooms, and the other one is a Chinese tea, which I'm not sure of the name, and you may know, but have you seen any evidence that either one of these, are you familiar with them, if you've seen any evidence that either one of these can deal with high cholesterol?
I've not seen any evidence that either one of those can adequately deal with high cholesterol, although it's plausible. And the reason why it's plausible is that many botanical preparations, you know, are actually what we use for drugs.
Yes.
Already.
Right.
And so the line between pharmaceuticals and natural medicine is actually a very blurred one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason why various kinds of herbs or mushrooms or teas might not contain something that pharmacologically has the effects of a prescription drug.
Okay. I have one last question, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed in your studies if some people are genetically disposed to having high cholesterol levels, and if you have seen that perhaps genetically some people are going to have high cholesterol levels, then should these people have to reach the same optimum cholesterol levels that's given for the general population?
That's an excellent question. There's no question that there are people who have genetic predispositions to high cholesterol levels, sometimes extremely high mm-hmm. cholesterol levels.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are beginning to understand about cholesterol reduction is that it looks like for people at high risk, the lower the cholesterol, the better you are. Now, you don't want to eradicate cholesterol because cholesterol is an important part of nervous system functioning. So you don't want to eliminate it, but it looks like within reasonable levels, the lower the better.
Mm-hmm.
And that would apply to people with very high levels as well.
But should the doctor be aggressive in trying to lower that if it seems to be genetically in this family that that person is predisposed? I'm just wondering if it's more harm for them to be on heavy doses of drugs to reduce that cholesterol level if it might be really genetically impossible because of the person's predisposition.
The proportion of people whose cholesterol levels cannot be brought down is actually relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
And the side effects and risks of the doses of medications, I think, are less risky than leaving the cholesterol levels at the high level.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go back to a caller in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering, similar to the last caller, in particular, there was a lot of talk about for high-risk people that maybe doubling the usual dose of statin would be the thing to do, and in particular, for example, Lipitor instead of 40 milligrams, 80 milligrams. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I would be a little bit cautious about typical doses or usual doses because there's no such thing as the usual dose for any individual. I mean, there are kind of commonly prescribed doses, but all of these things need to be regulated according to the individual response of the patient to achieve the result that you want. So there are many people, for example, you raised the example of Lipitor, which is one of the statin cholesterol-lowering drugs. There are many people who will respond to 10 milligrams of Lipitor and have remarkably low levels. There are some people who require 40 milligrams to get similar levels, and there are some people who require higher doses of Lipitor, and there have been a number of studies now that have been done using 80 milligrams of Lipitor as the effective limb to get the bad cholesterol level down to what looks like a favorable point. Favorable point being defined as a level in which we might expect to see lack of progression or even reversal of the disease, and that's sort of the target, for cholesterol reduction these days. So on the other hand, there are some people who don't respond to increased doses of the same medication. There are many people who will have no additional effect from doubling Lipitor, for example, and in people like that, you need to occasionally add a second drug to the Lipitor to get the cholesterol level down. The goal is to get the level down to what is likely to be a beneficial level rather than aiming for very specific doses.
Are you referring to the ratio between, say, LDL and HDL, or do you have a number that would be...
Well, the numbers are a moving target, but let's talk about some numbers. There's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol. Okay, the good cholesterol is something known as HDL cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein. And the more of that you have, the better off you are. And it's a complicated chemical process, but the bottom line for good cholesterol or HDL cholesterol is that it seems to be the kind of lipoprotein that is capable of taking cholesterol and fat out of the arteries and transporting them to the liver for disposition. So good cholesterol takes cholesterol away from the arteries. The bad cholesterol is known as LDL cholesterol, and that LDL cholesterol is the kind that brings fat into the arteries. And so the lower the bad cholesterol, the higher the good cholesterol, the better the overall balance of fat in and out of arteries seems to be. Now, the levels have changed dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years as studies have been done. And needless to say, studies began looking at the people at the highest risk. So the initial studies of cholesterol reduction, particularly LDL reduction, were begun in people at the highest risk, that is, those people who just had heart attacks, for example. They obviously have the disease. They are at risk of having another heart attack, and those are the people in whom cholesterol reduction seemed to be the most important. That kind of prevention, working in people who've already expressed their predisposition to having the disease, is known as secondary prevention because it's secondary to recognition of the disease. It didn't take long before people said, well, if this works for people who've had a heart attack, you know, maybe we should take it before you have the heart attack and skip the whole problem. And so that kind of intervention, as opposed to secondary prevention, is known as primary prevention. And it's not clear, and it hasn't been clear, whether the levels that are needed for secondary prevention and primary prevention are the same or different. But at any rate, people have started looking at lowering LDL levels, and we now tend to talk more about the LDL level rather than the total cholesterol level because that's the bad cholesterol level. And the guidelines have changed considerably. 10 years ago or 20 years ago, a total cholesterol level of 250 with an LDL level of 170 would not have bothered most people. As soon as the importance of lowering cholesterol became apparent in some of the secondary prevention studies, the general guidelines were that if you were at very little risk, that is, you were young, you were active, a non-smoker, and you had an LDL level that was below 160, that was probably okay. And then the most recent guidelines would suggest that if you have a little bit of a risk, if you have a family history or if you are a smoker or if you have good cholesterol levels, that is, low good cholesterol levels, maybe your level of LDL should be down below 130. And then if you've in fact had some expression of heart disease, your LDL level should be down below 100. And that's very hard to do with diet and exercise alone. I mean, that then is almost at the requirement for medication level. Those guidelines, which were national cholesterol target guidelines, approved and recommended by everyone from NIH to the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, everybody, you know, went along with this, are now actually starting to get lower. And it's turned out that there have been a number of trials that have suggested that while 100, an LDL below 100, seemed to be, you know, a good target level 5 years ago, a number of recent studies have shown that the levels down below 80 have had even more protective effect, both as secondary prevention and now starting to show up in primary prevention. So this is sort of an ongoing issue where the lower the bad cholesterol level, the more favorable the outcome seems to be, and where that will level off and stabilize, and to what degree everybody at some risk should have extreme lowering of LDL cholesterol levels is an ongoing scientific sort of investigation.
We only have about 5 minutes left, and we have a number of callers, and I'm sure that we can't take them all. I guess I would like to ask you just real quickly here about the possibility once someone has had heart disease, what can be done. For example, if you've had a heart attack, that's you're at risk for having another one. And we know that even people who go in for surgery to try to clean out arteries that have been clogged, it is possible that they can clog up again. So I'm sure that a lot of people, whether they have had a bypass, whether they have had a heart attack, or whether they have had some sort of routing out of their blood vessels because there's blockage, the big question is, what are my chances of having to do this again, or, you know, what are my chances of living a relatively long and healthy life having had this?
Right. I'm glad you brought it up because the focus of this book really is on secondary prevention for people who have had a heart attack or who have had bypass surgery. And bypass surgery does not cure the problem. Bypass surgery treats the problem like angioplasty treats the problem. But once people have expressed a potential for having this disease, it tends to be a progressive disease. So the book basically focuses on your question, which is, what are the things that can be done to make least likely the chance of having more problems. And there are sort of three areas that are dealt with. The first, and I think the unique feature of this book as opposed to some others, is that the more people understand about what all of this is about, the more likely they are to pursue and follow the correct treatment path. Nobody likes to take pills. Nobody likes to have side effects of anything. Nobody likes to pay for pills. And so you have to understand what this is all about in order to work best with your doctor. You need to find a doctor that you like. All of that's discussed. And then there are two categories of things that can be done. The first are things that your doctor does for you and with you. And those are a series of medications that have been shown to reduce the likelihood of having another heart attack and stabilizing the heart, keeping you alive longer. When you understand how these things work and why they work, you're more likely to take them than not take them. So, for example, these range from the simple, like aspirin, which cuts down on heart attacks, to more complex medications that interfere in some ways with some of the stress responses of the body. But all of these are things that have been very thoroughly studied, have a large scientific basis for being recommended for everybody who's had a heart attack. The second category of things, which we really haven't had too much time to discuss today, are the things that I think are even more important, and those are what you can do yourself to reduce your risk. It's not just about operations and pills. It's about reasonable and prudent lifestyle changes. For example, cardiac rehabilitation, beginning in an exercise program that's supervised and helps you to become more fit in response to physical effort, saves lives. It makes a big difference in terms of whether you're going to have another fatal heart attack. Keeping your blood pressure under control requires often back and forth visits with your doctor and tailoring the medication to get the effect that you want. Keeping your weight down and getting moving and getting exercising and doing what you can to lower your own bad cholesterol levels is tremendously important. Stopping smoking is critical. And it's probably the most important thing anybody coming out of the hospital can do. And you've already had a good start if you're just coming out of the hospital because you're not smoking in the coronary care unit. One of the striking comments that I've heard was from another cardiologist friend of mine who stopped smoking and said, you know, if I had a heart attack and you told me I had to stop smoking, I'd do it. So why not stop now and avoid the whole thing in the first place? I think that makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of good advice in here about how to stop smoking. And then, of course, you need to keep stress and rage under control, and there's some discussion of those things as well. So there are a large number of individual interventions. Some of them are simple. Some of them are things that you can do by yourself. Some of them are things that you need your doctor to do. But in order to get your doctor to do the best he can for you, you got to understand what's going on so you can participate in the process. And so I think the wisest thing that people can do is understand what the problem is and know what to ask their doctor about.
All right. We'll see if we can get at least one more caller. Savoy is next, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions I'd like to ask you. I've had very high cholesterol. I'm thin. I drink skim milk. I have a lot of fiber. I do all the things you'd think, so I guess I'm one of those genetically predisposed people. But in any case, I was wondering, if a person cuts way back on their cholesterol intake to try to control it without drugs, this is my first question, is it possible that because the body isn't getting enough because you've cut back so far that your liver begins, you know, going into hyper mode and spitting out the cholesterol, and then that produces some sort of an effect that sends it going up very high? That's my first question, if that's a possibility. My second is, what role sugar, because I have a sweet tooth, plays in the health of the arteries? And does it rough them up, as I've heard, and made them predisposed to the plaque clinging better to them? And I'll just hang up now and listen to your answers to those questions.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, you've asked two very important and very, very, very critical questions. The first is that having a high cholesterol is not always your fault. In fact, most of the time it's not your fault, it's genetic. And that if you don't eat cholesterol, your body will make cholesterol. It doesn't tend to make more cholesterol because you're depriving it of cholesterol, but it tends to set your cholesterol level at some genetically based point. And whether you eat cholesterol or don't eat cholesterol, it's going to generate a certain level of fat that you just can't do anything about. You can modify it a little bit, but you can't get beyond a certain limit. And so if you are one of what is sort of the more than average person, you can't control your cholesterol to current guideline levels very effectively without either extreme diets like being a vegetarian or using some of the medications. The sugar issue is a tremendously important one because diabetes is a very, very important additional risk for the development of the kinds of arterial diseases that we're talking about. And diabetes, in many ways, people think of as sugar abnormality, but it's really a disease of the arteries as well, and that's a consequence of the high sugar levels. Even where diabetes is not frank, there is a large series of abnormal consequences that come from having slightly high sugar levels. It kind of pushes up the insulin level, and high insulin, which is coming out of your body in an attempt to lower the modestly increased sugar levels, has its own series of metabolic problems that it causes and can interact very unfavorably with the arteries to cause more disease. So sugar control is very, very important.
There, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in, but we've simply used our time. And for people who are interested in reading more, I would suggest you might look at the book we've mentioned. It's titled The Cardiac Recovery Handbook. It's published by Healthy Living Books by our guest, Dr. Paul Klingfield, professor of medicine at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University and also director of the Cardiac Health Center in New York City. And Dr. Klingfield, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.